Chronology. 1938. Raymond Cleavy Carver is born in Clatskanie, Oregon, on May 25, first child of Ella Beatrice Casey and Cleavy Raymond, C.R., Carver. Ella, born in Magnet Cove, Arkansas, on July 11, 1913, was the youngest of four children of William Casey, 1882-1962, and Catherine Guise, 1886-1976. C.R., called Raymond by his family, was born in Gifford, Arkansas, on September 17, 1913, the youngest of three children of Edwin Frank Carver, 1877-1948, and Mary Green, 1880-1951. Carver descended from settlers and farmers who moved westward from the Carolinas, Georgia, Alabama, Tennessee, and Mississippi. Abraham Carver, 1815-1860, arrived in Arkansas around 1855 with his family and a few slaves, purchased several hundred acres in south-central Arkansas, and was considered prosperous. His eldest son, Robert Hosea Carver, 1835-1902, C.R.'s grandfather, acquired a homestead west of the Saline River near Leola, adjacent to the farm owned by William Jenkins, 1814-1859, and his wife, Jane McWhorter, 1818-1899, who together operated Jenkins Ferry, site of a noted Civil War battle on April 29-30, 1864. Robert married two Jenkins daughters, the second of whom, Elizabeth Ann Jenkins, 1842-1916, was C.R.'s grandmother. Robert and his younger brother, John M. Carver, 1841-1901, who married a third Jenkins daughter, fought for the Confederacy in 1862-63 and for the Union after November 1863. He fought for both sides, Carver later marveled, repeating C.R.'s story about his grandfather. He was a turncoat. In May 1929, in response to economic hardship in Arkansas caused by the floods of 1927, the loss of farms, collapse of cotton and timber prices, and widespread unemployment, C.R., aged 16, set out from Leola and traveled to Omak, Washington, with his parents and two older siblings, Fred, 1903-1984, and Violet Lavanda, 1910-2001, and their families, to find work in the apple orchards and sawmills of the Pacific Northwest. On a trip back to Arkansas in 1935, C.R. married Ella Casey, whom he had met only briefly on December 24. She returned with him to Omak, where he worked at the Biles Coleman Lumber Company. The mill was a hotbed of labor disputes in the 1930s, and when union workers went out on strike in spring 1936, C.R. took a job 50 miles away at the construction site of the Grand Coulee Dam. In 1938, C.R. and his pregnant wife followed his relatives to Wauna, Oregon, a mill town for the Crossett Western Company, part of an Arkansas-based timber conglomerate. C.R. was employed as a saw filer at the Wauna Lumber Mill on the Columbia River, 12 miles west of Clatskanie, where Ella gave birth to a boy in Dr. James Wooden's obstetrical offices on the second floor of a brick building on Nehalem Street, then known as the Clatskanie Hospital. 1941. The Carvers and members of their extended family move 200 miles northeast to Yakima, Washington, where C.R. takes a job as a saw filer for the Cascade Lumber Company. C.R., Ella, and their young son live in a rented house at 1515 South 15th Street in the rundown Fairview section opposite the Central Washington Fairgrounds. The house lacks an indoor toilet and is the first home that Carver will remember. 1943. Carver's only sibling, James Franklin Carver, is born in Yakima on August 18. 1944. Carver enters the first grade at Jefferson School, a Yakima public elementary school, which he attends from September 1944 to June 1950. He is an excellent reader, an indifferent arithmetic student, and a fun-loving boy easily distracted in class. His father buys him books, and tells him stories about relatives in Arkansas and Depression-era adventures. Carver writes, little stories about monsters, ants, laboratories, and mad doctors. The family has no car, and CR travels by bus to his job at the mill on the Yakima River northeast of town. Carver often waits at the bus stop for his dad to come home from work. Periodically, CR fails to arrive, having instead gone out drinking with friends. I still remember the sense of doom and hopelessness that hung over the supper table when my mother and I and my kid brother sat down to eat. 1950. In September, Carver begins seventh grade at Washington Junior High School, where he is a student until June 1953. Before he enters junior high, his parents buy a small house in a modest middle-class neighborhood on 11th Avenue near Meade Avenue in Yakima. The family's years in this house are the happiest period of his childhood. He and his father hunt ducks and geese in the woods and fish for bass and perch in the ponds and streams around Yakima. Among Carver's haunts are Sportsman Park, Wenis Lake, Athenham Creek, and Bachelor Creek, places that will figure in his poems and stories. That's what excited me in those days, hunting and fishing. That's what made a dent in my emotional life, and that's what I wanted to write about. His other passion is books. Once a week, he walks to the Yakima Public Library. I wanted to be a writer, and I mostly followed my nose as far as reading was concerned. He reads science fiction, westerns, jungle adventures, and history books. My favorite author was Edgar Rice Burroughs. I read all of his books, and most of them, 5, 6, and 8 times. 1953. Carver enters 10th grade at Yakima Senior High School in September. His father pays for him to enroll in a correspondence course in creative writing offered by the Palmer Institute of Authorship in Los Angeles. He works part-time as a delivery boy for Wolf's Pharmacy, one of three drugstores owned by pharmacist Albert B. Kurbitz, who offers to pay Carver's college tuition if he promises to study pharmacy and return to Yakima to manage a drugstore, an offer Carver declines. On one delivery, he meets an anonymous and lovely old gentleman who talks to him about writing and gives him an issue of Poetry Magazine and Margaret Anderson's Little Review Anthology, 1953. Carver recalled this meeting as a pole star in his literary education. I had the distinct feeling my life was in the process of being altered in some significant and even, forgive me, magnificent way. 1955. CR sells the family's home on 11th Avenue and rents a larger house at 3515 Summit View Avenue in a more prosperous part of Yakima. In the summer between Carver's junior and senior years of high school, he works at a grocery store 3 miles south of Yakima in Union Gap, where his mother is a waitress at the Spudnut Shop. Spudnuts are donuts made from potato flour, and franchise Spudnut shops proliferated in the 1950s. Also working at the shop is 14-year-old Marianne Elsie Burke, born August 7, 1940, in Bellingham, Washington, the middle child among the three daughters of Yakima schoolteacher Alice Ritchie and her former husband, Valentine R. Val Burke, who owns a farm in Blaine, Washington. The teenagers begin dating, although Marianne is slated to move 130 miles away in September to resume her studies at St. Paul's School for Girls, an Episcopalian boarding school in Walla Walla, Washington. That summer, CR moves to Chester, a logging town 600 miles south of Yakima on the shore of Lake Almanor in northeastern California, and takes a job at the Collins Pine Company sawmill where his brother Fred has found better-paying work. Ella and her two sons remain in Yakima so Carver can finish high school. 1956. Carver graduates from high school on June 7. He relocates with his mother and brother to Chester, where they discover CR to be seriously ill with what family members believe is blood poisoning caused by an injury on the job. Carver joins the chain gang at the Collins Pine Mill, hauling freshly cut lumber away from the saws. Marianne visits the family in Chester during summer vacation before going back to school. After briefly enlisting in the Army National Guard of California, Carver returns to Yakima in November to be closer to Marianne, staying with his Aunt Vaughn, LaVonda Carver, and Uncle Bill, William T., Archer, and working at Wolf's Pharmacy. 1957. Inspired by H. Rider Haggard's adventure novel, King Solomon's Mines, 1885, and its 1950 movie adaptation, Carver sets out with two friends to hunt for diamonds in South America, getting as far as Guaymas in northern Mexico before the three fall ill, quarrel, and separate. He returns to Chester, then to Yakima. In the spring, Marianne learns that she and Carver are expecting a child. Shortly after her high school graduation, the couple are married on June 7 at St. Michael's Episcopal Church, the oldest church in Yakima. The wedding is followed by a reception at Playland, a popular dance hall in the nearby town of Sela, and a one-week honeymoon in Seattle. CR's health has badly deteriorated in Chester. His physical ailments, compounded by depression and substance abuse, render him unable to work, and he returns with his wife and son James to Yakima, where they live on the charity of relatives. Carver and Marianne are also living in Yakima, in a basement apartment below a doctor's office, which they clean at night in lieu of paying rent. In the fall, Carver takes two classes at Yakima Valley Community College. Their daughter, Christine LaRay, is born on December 2 at Yakima Valley Memorial Hospital. CR, whose depression has become acute, is a patient in the same hospital. Carver visits his father and his wife on different floors on the day his first child is born. Confined for weeks in the psychiatric ward, CR undergoes electroshock therapy and will be unable to hold a steady job for 6 years after his release. 1958. In August, Carver, his wife, and daughter move to Paradise, California, in the northern foothills of the Central Valley, where they live in a house that Marianne's mother has purchased as a future retirement property on Roe Road. He begins working at a drugstore and taking classes at Chico State College, 12 miles to the west. The second of the couple's two children, Vance Lindsay, is born at Enloe Hospital in Chico on October 19. Carver's first publication appears in the Chico State student newspaper, The Wildcat, on October 31. It is a letter to the editor headed, "Where is Intellect?" lamenting student apathy on campus. 1959. In the spring, Carver moves with his family to Chico, where Marianne begins working as a telephone operator. That fall, he enrolls in Creative Writing 101, taught by a new faculty member at Chico State, John Gardner, who takes a special interest in his work. He'd take one of my early efforts at a story and go over it with me. He made me see that absolutely everything was important in a story. Gardner gives Carver a key to his faculty office to use as a private place for writing. 1960. During the spring term, Carver and fellow student Nancy Park edit and publish the first issue of the Chico State literary magazine, Selection. To launch it memorably, Carver asks his greatest hero, William Carlos Williams, for a submission and receives the previously unpublished poem, The Gossips. In June, the Carvers move 200 miles northwest to Eureka, California, where Marianne works during the day at the local telephone company, and Carver finds night work in area sawmills. Each takes care of the children while the other is away. They rent a small house on Artino Road. In the fall, he begins classes at Humboldt State College, 8 miles north of Eureka in the foggy woods of Arcata. Among his teachers is a new instructor, Richard Cortez Dick Day, who becomes a lifelong friend. Stories written for Day's classes include The Hare and The Night the Mill Boss Died. The second issue of Selection contains Carver's first published story, The Furious Seasons, written under Gardner's mentorship at Chico State. 1961. The Father, a story written for Day's class, appears in the spring issue of Toyon, the Humboldt State Literary Journal. In the summer, seeking a change of pace, the Carvers drive 700 miles north to Blaine, Washington, near the Canadian border. There, Marianne's father, Val Burke, and her paternal aunt May, Mary Kay Burke, operate a farm that has been owned by the Burke family since 1886. They plan to stay a year, but Carver soon feels anxious and unproductive in the isolated rural setting. In August, he returns with his family to Northern California, renting a house on I Street in the Northtown section of Arcata. In the fall, he and Marianne take classes at Humboldt State while holding jobs. She is a waitress, and he is an assistant in the college library. They socialize with Dick Day, Dave Palmer, a college reference librarian and poet, and their wives, as well as with Amy Burke, Marianne's younger sister, who is an aspiring actress. 1962. In the spring, to shore up the family's finances, Carver takes a second part-time job at a sawmill. His curriculum at Humboldt State includes an independent study in Russian literature with Thelwall Proctor and a modern drama course with longtime Oregon Shakespeare Festival director Jerry Turner. On May 11, Carver's absurdist one-act play, Carnations, is performed on campus. The audience had the chance to meet the author after the play, but what happened was more like a public hanging. That experience is offset when, on a single red letter day, two works he has submitted to off-campus literary magazines are accepted for publication. His poem, The Brass Ring, appears in the September issue of Targets, and his story, Pastoral, is published early the next year in Western Humanities Review. 1963. On February 1, Carver receives his BA in English from Humboldt State. He edits the spring issue of Toyon, which includes his stories Poseidon and Company and The Hare, and two works under the pseudonym John Vale. His poem, Spring, 480 BC, and his Hemingway satire, The Aficionados. With Dick Day's help, he receives a $1,000 fellowship in support of a year's study at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, beginning in the fall. For the spring and summer, he accepts a job in a library at the University of California, Berkeley, nearly 300 miles away. Marianne remains in Arcata with the children to complete spring classes at Humboldt State. When her semester ends, the family reunites in Berkeley. In late summer, they drive to Iowa City, where Carver enrolls in the workshop's two-year MFA program. They move into Hawkeye Trailer Park, then into Finkbein Park, a complex of World War II-era Quonset huts that serves as married student housing. While Carver takes classes with R.V. Castle and other writers, Marianne works as a waitress at the University Athletic Club. The Furious Seasons, revised and published in the fall issue of the little magazine December, is listed among the distinctive short stories in American and Canadian magazines 1963 in Best American Short Stories 1964. 1964. Isolation from family and friends, coupled with the frigid Iowa winter, takes a toll on the Carvers' morale. When Marianne's father dies unexpectedly in January in Blaine, Washington, she and the children travel west by train for the funeral, leaving Carver to his classes for the next month. Under the mentorship of Irish short story writer Brian McMahon, he drafts several new stories, including The Student's Wife, 60 Acres, and Will You Please Be Quiet, Please? The burst of creativity strengthens his desire to leave school and write full-time, but also underscores his sense that a writer's life is beyond his grasp, given his position of unrelieved responsibility and permanent distraction as the father of two children. In June, after he completes his first year at the writer's workshop, the family returns to California. They settle in Sacramento, where his parents are living on CR's disability payments and intermittent income from Ella's jobs in eateries and retail stores. Marianne works as a waitress and restaurant hostess. Carver has a hard time finding work that allows him time to write. He takes a series of crap jobs and is eventually hired as a custodian at Sacramento's Mercy Hospital, a post he will hold for 2 years. CR finds steady work after 6 years of illness and unemployment. He is offered a job at a sawmill 350 miles to the north in California's Redwood Country, near the town of Klamath. In time, Ella joins him, and they move to Crescent City, 20 miles north of Klamath. 1965. In January, Marianne begins working for the Parents Cultural Institute, an educational product subsidiary of Parents Magazine. She sells instructional kits for children door to door, produces good sales figures, and is promoted, first to team manager, then to regional manager. She is given a red Pontiac convertible to make sales calls from her base in Sacramento. The Carvers rent a small house at 2641 Matheson Way, then a larger one at 2642 Larkspur Lane. They hire a housekeeper and enjoy a period of relative economic stability. After a year on the day shift at Mercy Hospital, Carver transfers to the night shift. He can finish his duties quickly, go home to sleep, and write the next day. In time, instead of returning home from work, he begins going out to drink with friends. 1966. The poet Dennis Schmitz joins the faculty of Sacramento State College, and in the fall, Carver sits in on Schmitz's undergraduate course in creative writing. In the class is Gary Thompson, a poet who, like Schmitz, becomes Carver's close friend. Will You Please Be Quiet, Please? Is published in December. 1967. Marianne's success at the Parents Cultural Institute brings an offer of further advancement. The post will require extended travel, and Carver objects to her taking it. She yields to his wishes but falls into a sales slump, severely reducing her income. Borrowing and overspending on credit worsen the couple's financial woes. On April 14, they file for bankruptcy protection. Marianne resigns from her job, and the Carvers vacate their rental home. She secures a position as a live-in manager of the Riviera Apartments, a poolside complex at 940 Fulton Avenue in Sacramento, where the family can stay rent-free. Carver quits his job at Mercy Hospital, decides to become a librarian, and is accepted into the master's program of the University of Iowa's School of Library Science. He drives with Gary Thompson to Iowa City in June, but the trip is cut short when he receives word that his father, aged 53, has died on June 17 in Crescent City, California. He flies back to the West Coast and drives north to his parents' home. His mother arranges for CR's body to be transported 500 miles to Yakima for burial. Ella Carver will survive her husband for 25 years and die in Sacramento County on April 18, 1993. Carver abandons his plan to attend library school and returns to Sacramento. He is hired for his first white-collar job as a textbook editor at the educational publishing firm of Science Research Associates, SRA, in Palo Alto, California, where the family rents a house at 886 Loma Verde Avenue. Marianne takes classes at Foothill College, a two-year institution in nearby Los Altos Hills. Kurt Johnson, publisher of December, visits Carver to celebrate the selection of Will You Please Be Quiet, Please? By editor Martha Foley for Best American Short Stories 1967. It was the most momentous thing in regard to my writing that had ever happened to me. Johnson introduces Carver to Gordon Lish, a December contributor and founding editor of the avant-garde journal Genesis West, then working at another textbook company in Palo Alto. 1968. In the spring, Carver's first book, the poetry collection Near Klamath, is published by the English Club of Sacramento State College. To pursue a bachelor's degree in English, Marianne transfers to San Jose State College. There she receives a one-year, $5,000 fellowship to study in Israel, beginning in the summer. Carver arranges a year's leave from SRA, and in June the family flies to Tel Aviv. The accommodations at the University of Tel Aviv fall far short of expectations. They promised us a villa on the Mediterranean. Instead, the house was awful, the kids were miserable, and we ran out of money. In October, the Carvers leave Israel and return to the United States by way of a cruise on the Aegean and a tour of Greece, Italy, and France. In November, they arrive in Hollywood, California, where they stay in a rented house on Gregory Avenue, near Marianne's sister Amy and her husband Michael Wright. To support themselves while seeking jobs as actors, Amy and Michael hawk souvenir movie programs on Hollywood Boulevard. Carver joins them for a time, attempting to sell programs for Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. Marianne makes good money as a cocktail waitress at a storied Hollywood restaurant, Edna Earle's Fog Cutter. 1969. The Carvers move to San Jose, California in January. They rent an apartment on 7th Street in Spartan Village, a student housing complex at San Jose State College, where Marianne resumes her undergraduate studies. In February, Carver is rehired at SRA, this time as advertising director. During quarterly collating parties at the San Francisco home of George Hitchcock, founding editor of Kayak magazine, Carver meets fellow writers and lifelong friends Morton Marcus and James D. Houston. Both men live 70 miles south of San Francisco in Santa Cruz. Hitchcock moves there, bringing with him Kayak and his small press, Kayak Books. Gordon Lish, now fiction editor of Esquire magazine, writes to Carver in November, urging him to submit stories. 1970. Carver receives a promotion at SRA, but his goal remains to be a full-time writer. In March, he wins a $3,000 Discovery Award for poetry from the National Endowment for the Arts. Winter Insomnia, his second book of poems, is published by Kayak Books in the spring. While representing SRA at a teachers' conference in Seattle, Carver meets Montana-based writer William Kittredge, who becomes a lasting friend. In June, the Carvers move to Sunnyvale, California, 12 miles west of San Jose. They rent a house on Wright Avenue from a high school teacher on a year's sabbatical in Germany, a situation adapted for the story Put Yourself in My Shoes. In the summer, Marianne completes her BA in English at San Jose State and enters an accelerated teacher certification program. In August, she is hired as an English teacher at Los Altos High School, a position she will hold for 8 years. During the summer, Carver rents a room in Palo Alto as a writing studio, where he drafts a story called The Neighbors. Its idea comes from an experience he had in Tel Aviv, when he was given private access to the apartment of neighbors who were out of town. In August, he submits The Neighbors to Lish, who line edits the text, shortens the title to Neighbors, and accepts the story for publication in Esquire. Carver is bowled over and expresses his gratitude to Lish. This is a milestone, a turning point. The friendship between writer and editor is supportive and productive. One of the things that was so helpful about Gordon was that he believed in me as a writer when I needed that, when I had no other contact with the great world, living as I was in Sunnyvale and Cupertino, California. On September 25, Carver's job at SRA is eliminated in a reorganization. A year's severance pay, supplemented by his NEA award and Marianne's teaching salary, enables him to write full-time. 60 Acres is included in Best Little Magazine Fiction, 1970. 1971. Unencumbered by a job, Carver writes many of the stories that make up his first trade press book, Will You Please Be Quiet, Please, 1976. Something happened during that time in the writing, to the writing. It went underground, and then it came up again, and it was bathed in a new light for me. I was starting to chip away, down to the image, then the figure itself. And it happened during that period. In the spring, he shares the San Francisco Foundation's annual Joseph Henry Jackson Award for the most promising young writer in Northern California. Neighbors is published in Esquire in June. George Hitchcock joins the faculty of the University of California, Santa Cruz. He recommends Carver to James B. Hall, a writer who has been appointed provost of College 5, a new arts unit within the university. Hall hires Carver for his first teaching post as a visiting lecturer in creative writing beginning in the fall. In August, the Carvers leave Sunnyvale and rent a home in Ben Lomond, a rustic community among the redwoods of the San Lorenzo Valley, 12 miles north of Santa Cruz. The story Fat is published in Harper's Bazaar in September. A Night Out is included in Best Little Magazine Fiction 1971. When classes begin at UC Santa Cruz, Carver serves as founding editor of the journal Quarry, later Quarry West. The first issue contains poems by Morton Marcus, a story by William Kittredge, contributions by Leonard Michaels, Richard Hugo and John Haynes, and Gordon Lish's essay, How I Got to Be a Big Shot Editor and Other Worthwhile Self-Justifications. 1972. Carver holds multiple academic positions simultaneously without informing his employers about his obligations to the others. In the spring, while teaching at UC Santa Cruz, he accepts a Wallace E. Stegner Fellowship at Stanford University that requires him to attend classes in Palo Alto. He also accepts an appointment, to begin in the fall, as a visiting lecturer at the University of California, Berkeley. In July, the Carvers make their first and only home purchase, a ranch-style house with a circular driveway at 22272 Cupertino Road in Cupertino, California. Cupertino is near San Jose, but it is at least an hour's drive from Berkeley and almost 2 hours from Santa Cruz. In August, Carver drives to Montana without Marianne to celebrate William Kittredge's 40th birthday. Kittredge introduces him to several hard-drinking Missoula writers, including novelists James Crumley, James Welch, and Chuck Kinder. Carver and Kinder have previously met at Stanford, and they become good friends. At Kittredge's party, Carver meets Diane Cecily, with whom he begins a sexual liaison that, unlike his earlier flings, continues for several years. His persistent infidelity, coupled with his and Marianne's heavy drinking, leads to violent arguments. Late in the year, he rents an apartment in Berkeley, where he stays for part of each week. Having a pied-à-terre cuts down on his driving time and facilitates his affair with Cecily. 1973. Constant shuttling between universities and residences earns Carver the nickname Running Dog. When he accepts an appointment as visiting lecturer at the Iowa Writers' Workshop for the fall term, he resigns his position at UC Berkeley, but retains his job at UC Santa Cruz. His commitment to teach classes each week in Iowa and California entails tightly scheduled air travel, with the house in Cupertino serving as a hub. When in Iowa City, he lives on campus in the Iowa House and befriends fellow resident and visiting faculty member John Cheever. Carver and Cheever meet their classes, but otherwise do little except drink, sometimes together in Cheever's room. I don't think either of us ever took the covers off our typewriters. We made trips to a liquor store twice a week in my car, Carver recalled. What Is It? Is included in the O. Henry Awards annual Prize Stories 1973. 5 of Carver's poems are reprinted in New Voices in American Poetry. 1974. Carver resigns from UC Santa Cruz and, for the spring semester, moves alone to Iowa City, where he continues teaching at the Writers' Workshop. He returns to Cupertino in May. Overspending has again put the Carvers deep in debt, and they file for bankruptcy protection a second time. He accepts a visiting lectureship at the University of California, Santa Barbara, for the academic year 1974-75. Marianne arranges a year's leave from Los Altos High School to accompany him. They rent out their house in Cupertino and move 300 miles south to Goleta, a coastal town near the Santa Barbara campus. During the fall term, both Carver and Marianne are arrested for driving while intoxicated. Symptoms of alcoholism force him to resign from UC Santa Barbara at the end of the semester. In December, the couple return to Cupertino. Put Yourself in My Shoes is included in Prize Stories 1974 and is printed as a chapbook by Santa Barbara-based Capra Press, founded by Noel Young, who remains Carver's friend and publisher for many years. 1975. Out of work, unable to write, and morbidly ill, Carver lives with his wife and teenage children in Cupertino. His drinking and extramarital affairs continue, leading to domestic turmoil and occasional violence. On leave from her teaching job, Marianne works as a cocktail waitress. Carver is admitted to a short-term treatment center in San Jose, where he suffers an alcohol withdrawal seizure. Are You a Doctor? Is included in Prize Stories 1975. 1976. As Carver's health declines, his literary profile rises, thanks to the appearance of older writings. His third book of poetry, At Night the Salmon Move, is published in February by Capra Press. In New York, Lish's advocacy of Carver's work bears fruit. In March, under the newly established Gordon Lish imprint, McGraw-Hill publishes Carver's first book of fiction, Will You Please Be Quiet, Please? It contains 22 stories, all previously published in periodicals, each further edited by Lish with Carver's approval. The book receives a short but positive review by Jeffrey Wolfe in the New York Times on March 7. A story not in the collection, So Much Water, So Close to Home, is selected for the first annual Pushcart Prize anthology. During the year, Carver undergoes multiple hospitalizations for acute alcoholism. In October, the house on Cupertino Road is sold, and Marianne rents a home on nearby Carmen Road. After Thanksgiving, the couple live apart. Carver rents an apartment but soon moves in with his former secretary from SRA. He ends the year at Duffy's, a residential treatment center in Calistoga, California, in the Napa Valley, 70 miles north of San Francisco. I was completely out of control and in a very grave place. I was dying from it, plain and simple, and I'm not exaggerating. 1977. Carver's self-imposed confinement at Duffy's extends into the new year. The setting is recalled in his story, Where I'm Calling From. When he leaves the facility in January, he attempts to limit his drinking, but relapses around social drinkers. He stays briefly in San Francisco with Marianne's sister Amy and her second husband, the novelist Douglas Unger. In February, Dick Day arranges for him to rent a house in the relatively isolated community of McKinleyville, California, 8 miles north of Arcata, near the Pacific Ocean. The house at 1131 Henry Lane is behind a restaurant off Bella Vista Road. Both the house and the Bella Vista restaurant are owned by Edward Pete Peterson, who operates the establishment with his second wife, Betty. Chef's House is one of three stories set in this locale. The others are What Would You Like to See and Call If You Need Me. During the spring, Carver lives alone and tries to quit drinking. His efforts collapse in late May when he goes to San Francisco for a meeting with Fred Hills, editor-in-chief at McGraw-Hill. At a party, Carver drinks and blacks out. He wakes up drunk and sick but manages to keep his appointment with Hills, who offers him an advance on a proposed novel. A portion of this never-completed book, likely its entirety, is published as From the Augustine Notebooks in 1979. Returning to McKinleyville, he briefly continues to drink. On June 2, the day he will call the line of demarcation, he stops drinking. Sick for 4 days afterward, he emerges shaky but sober, and he never drinks again. I'm prouder of that I've quit drinking than I am of anything in my life. Participation in Alcoholics Anonymous helps him maintain sobriety. Carver and Marianne reunite for their 20th anniversary on June 7. She takes a leave from Los Altos High School, and they live together in McKinleyville through the summer and fall. The first published interview with Carver, accolade-winning author returns to Humboldt, appears in the Eureka Times Standard on July 24. During this time, he applies for fellowships and teaching jobs, and he writes two new stories, Viewfinder and Why Don't You Dance? In November, he attends a conference at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas, where he meets two key figures, both writers, of his post-alcoholic second life. One is Richard Ford, with whom he has previously corresponded and who becomes a close friend. The other is Tess Gallagher. Born Teresa Jeanette Bond in Port Angeles, Washington, on July 21, 1943, she shares Carver's Southern heritage, Northwestern upbringing, and working-class background. She is the oldest of five children of Leslie Bond and Georgia Morris, a Missouri native, both of whom have worked as loggers. Twice divorced, Gallagher is a poet, essayist, and creative writing teacher. She and Carver will begin an association that leads to literary collaboration, reciprocal influence, and intimate partnership. Carver's second collection of fiction, Furious Seasons and Other Stories, is published in November by Capra Press. It contains 8 stories, none of which had appeared in Will You Please Be Quiet, Please? 1978. Carver and Marianne leave McKinleyville in January. He is hired to teach in the creative writing program of Goddard College in Plainfield, Vermont. She rents a room in Arcata and continues working as a cocktail waitress while on leave from teaching. It is unclear when they will resume living together. He travels to northern Vermont for the 2-week campus-based portion of the program. Other instructors include Donald Hall, Tobias Wolfe, and Stephen Dobins. After the session, Carver goes to Illinois and remains for a week in Kurt Johnson's remote vacation cabin. Freezing weather and isolation prompt him to depart for Iowa City. There he stays first with Dobins, who is teaching at the writer's workshop, then in a rented room. Carver's application for a Guggenheim Fellowship is approved, and he receives an appointment as visiting distinguished writer-in-residence at the University of Texas, El Paso, beginning in the fall. In March, he flies to California, then drives back to Iowa City with Marianne, who resigns from her position at Los Altos High School. They move out of his rented room and into the Park Motel on Interstate 80. He reads at the writer's workshop on April 18. In late spring, they rent an apartment in town, but he soon takes separate quarters where he lives and writes. Marianne moves back to California on July 24, the date that marks their separation. In August, Carver leaves Iowa City for El Paso. His car breaks down in the desert at Van Horn, Texas, and he continues by Greyhound bus, arriving in El Paso with a single suitcase. He stays with a faculty couple, the writers Bruce and Patricia Dobler, and participates in a 2-week literary conference, then in progress at the university, where he meets Tess Gallagher for the second time. They socialize with other attendees, dine together, and attend a bullfight in Juarez, Mexico, with the Doblers. In the fall, when Gallagher returns to her cabin on Discovery Bay in northwest Washington State, she and Carver correspond, and he visits her on holidays. His book reviews begin appearing in the Chicago Tribune, Texas Monthly, and the San Francisco Review of Books. 1979. On January 1, Carver and Gallagher, who is a Guggenheim Fellow, begin living together in a rented house in El Paso near the Mexican border. A critical study, Will You Please Be Quiet, Please? Voyeurism, Dissociation, and the Art of Raymond Carver by David Boxer and Cassandra Phillips appears in the summer issue of Iowa Review. Carver accepts an appointment as professor of English at Syracuse University in upstate New York. He defers the position for a year, during which he will hold his Guggenheim Fellowship and write stories. Gallagher and he spend the summer in a cabin in Chemakum, Washington, on the Olympic Peninsula. In the fall, they move to Tucson, where she has a teaching appointment at the University of Arizona. They live in a house she has purchased at 2905 East 23rd Street. There, Carver works on new stories, including Gazebo, One More Thing, Pie, If It Please You, Where Is Everyone, and Beginners. 1980. Carver is awarded a literature fellowship for fiction by the National Endowment for the Arts. Unexpectedly, he assumes his teaching post at Syracuse University in late January, departing Tucson a semester early to replace George P. Eliot, senior professor of English and creative writing, who has fallen ill. Gallagher remains in Arizona during the spring term. In Syracuse, Carver takes up temporary residence at 1064 Westmoreland Avenue in a house originally rented by poet Hayden Carruth, and continues working on new stories, including Want to See Something and A Small Good Thing. On February 15, he writes Gordon Lish, now a book editor at Alfred A. Knopf, to say he has completed a number of new stories, perhaps enough for a book, when added to previously uncollected fiction. I've been writing stories these last 6 months steadily, a few good ones, I think. I have a long one in the works now, 40 pages. In early May, they meet in New York City, and Carver gives Lish an untitled manuscript of stories. In Syracuse, Carver and Gallagher jointly purchase a two-story wood-shingled house at 832 Maryland Avenue. In mid-June, they travel to the University of Alaska at Fairbanks to participate in the Midnight Sun Writers Conference. During May and June, Lish edits Carver's manuscript aggressively, reducing its overall length by more than half. Carver returns alone to Syracuse, and on July 7, he reads the edited stories for the first time. He writes to Lish at 8 a.m. on July 8, expressing profound dismay at the alterations. The stories are central, he says, to his recovery from alcoholism. Despite Lish's genius as an editor, Carver insists that publication of the book, now entitled What We Talk About When We Talk About Love, be canceled. Lish convinces him that the changes are improvements and production of the book goes forward. Carver rejoins Gallagher in Port Angeles, Washington on July 15. When they return to Syracuse University later that summer, Gallagher begins an appointment as professor of English and coordinator of the creative writing program. The faculty includes Tobias Wolfe, Stephen Dobins, and Douglas Unger. Among the students are Jay McInerney and Mary Bush. Carver edits a sampler of student writings, Syracuse Poems and Stories, 1980. In his foreword, collected under the title Steering by the Stars, he writes, "We have here the makings of a literary community." 1981. Carver's essay, A Storyteller's Shop Talk, later retitled On Writing, appears in the New York Times Book Review on February 15. What We Talk About When We Talk About Love is published by Knopf on April 20 and receives a favorable front-page review by Michael Wood in the New York Times Book Review on April 26. In the June issue of The Atlantic, James Atlas offers a less positive assessment, but says of the elliptical, enigmatic narratives, "Their very minimality gives them a certain bleak power." Unaware that the stories have been shortened by Lish, critics label Carver a minimalist. He chafes at the description. "There's something about minimalist that smacks of smallness of vision and execution that I don't like." New stories appear in the fall. They include Cathedral, Vitamins, and Carver's first publication in The New Yorker, Chef's House. In style and scale, these stories differ markedly from those in his minimalist collection. Two stories in What We Talk About When We Talk About Love win awards. The title story is included in the Pushcart Prize, 6, and The Bath wins Columbia Magazine's Carlos Fuentes Fiction Award. 1982. Under the guest editorship of poet Donald Hall, Plowshares publishes a restored version of A Small Good Thing. Hall, who had read several stories before they were edited for What We Talk About When We Talk About Love, asked Carver to submit the original story about the baker. On June 23, Carver files for divorce from Marianne in New York State Court. Their divorce becomes final on October 18. Carver and Gallagher travel in Europe during the summer, visiting Germany, Switzerland, and France. He is elected a member of the Corporation of Yaddo, an artist's retreat in Saratoga Springs, New York. His autobiographical essay, Fires, written while in residence at Yaddo, appears in the autumn issue of Antaeus. In September, film director Michael Cimino and producer Carlo Ponti commission Carver and Gallagher to rewrite a screenplay based on the life of Fyodor Dostoevsky. The film is never produced. With his share of the proceeds, Carver purchases what Gallagher calls the Mercedes that Dostoevsky bought. Guest editor John Gardner includes Cathedral in Best American Short Stories, 1982. On September 14, Gardner dies in a motorcycle accident. In October, The Pheasant is published in book form by William Ferguson's Metacom Press. Carver and Gallagher spend the winter holidays in her newly built home in Port Angeles. Her glass-walled sky house overlooks the Strait of Juan de Fuca, the 22-mile-wide waterway that separates the U.S. from Canada. 1983. Carver continues publishing new stories and restored versions of older ones that had appeared in What We Talk About When We Talk About Love. His miscellany, Fires, Essays, Poems, and Stories, is published by Capra Press on April 14. It includes a full-length version of So Much Water So Close to Home and restorations of Distance and Where Is Everyone. On May 18, the American Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters awards Carver and Cynthia Ozick its first Mildred and Harold Strauss Livings. The renewable 5-year fellowships carry annual tax-free stipends of $35,000 to support full-time writing. As a condition of the award, he resigns his professorship at Syracuse. His essay, John Gardner, Writer and Teacher, appears in the summer issue of Georgia Review. It serves as the foreword to Gardner's posthumous book on becoming a novelist. A long interview with Carver by Mona Simpson and Louis Busby appears in the summer issue of the Paris Review. In it, for the first time, he talks publicly about his alcoholism. He also contrasts the stories in What We Talk About When We Talk About Love with his more recent fiction, notably Cathedral. There was an opening up when I wrote the story. I knew I'd gone as far the other way as I could or wanted to go, cutting everything down to the marrow, not just to the bone. Lish remains his editor at Knopf, but Carver insists on complete control of his stories, restricting Lish to standard copy editing. Their professional and personal relationship ends abruptly in the spring. Robert Gottlieb, editor-in-chief of the firm, becomes Carver's titular editor. Knopf publishes Cathedral in September. The collection includes 12 stories, 11 of them written in the past 2 years. The longest is A Small Good Thing, a full-length restoration of its Lish-edited counterpart, The Bath, in What We Talk About When We Talk About Love. On September 11, a review of Cathedral by Irving Howe appears on the front page of the New York Times Book Review. Based on a close comparison of The Bath and A Small Good Thing, he concludes that the longer version is the better story and that the new collection is Carver's best book. Cathedral shows a gifted writer struggling for a larger scope of reference, a finer touch of nuance. Guest editor Ann Tyler includes Where I'm Calling From in Best American Short Stories 1983. A Small Good Thing appears in the 8th annual Pushcart Prize Anthology and wins first place honors in Prize Stories 1983, the O. Henry Awards. Cathedral is nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award and a Pulitzer Prize. 1984. Carver retreats to Port Angeles in January to secure privacy to write. He lives alone in Sky House after Gallagher returns to Syracuse to teach. His plan is to write a work of long fiction, but instead he begins writing poetry and continues doing so for 10 weeks. I've never had a period in which I've taken such joy in the act of writing as I did in those 2 months. He also writes nonfiction. His review of Sherwood Anderson's Selected Letters appears in the New York Times Book Review on April 22. He contributes a foreword to William Kittredge's story collection, We Are Not in This Together. Raymond Carver, a chronicler of blue-collar despair, a 5,000-word feature article by Bruce Weber, appears in the New York Times Magazine on June 28. In the summer, Carver and Gallagher make a reading tour of Brazil and Argentina under the auspices of the U.S. Information Agency. They are visited in Port Angeles by the novelist Haruki Murakami, who will translate Carver's writings into Japanese. My Father's Life, Carver's essay on CR, appears in the September issue of Esquire. His story, If It Please You, restored to full length after Lish's cuts, is published as a limited edition book by Lord John Press. 7 of Carver's poems appear in William Hayen's anthology, The Generation of 2000. His story, Careful, is included in the Pushcart Prize, 9. 1985. In January, Carver purchases a home at 602 South B Street in Port Angeles. The renovated Victorian-era farmhouse is in a working-class neighborhood above the harbor, and the Rainier Pulp Mill. He and Gallagher share their two residences. Five of his poems appear in the February issue of Poetry. His poetry collection, Where Water Comes Together with Other Water, is published by Random House on May 1. In the spring, two books by Carver are published in England, an expanded edition of Fires, published by Collins Harville on April 15, and The Stories of Raymond Carver, a collection of three books in one volume, published by Pan Picador on May 16. Carter and Gallagher fly to London for promotional appearances. Dostoevsky, a screenplay, the couple's co-authored film script, is published by Capra Press in the fall. His review of two biographies of Ernest Hemingway appears in the New York Times Book Review on November 17. That month, he wins Poetry Magazine's annual Levinson Prize. The winter issue of Mississippi Review, guest edited by Kim Herzinger, includes a special section on minimalist fiction and contains a long interview with Carver by Larry McCaffrey and Cinda Gregory. At year's end, he returns to writing fiction. 1986. During the winter, Carver continues writing stories. Four are published in The New Yorker between February and July: Boxes, Whoever Was Using This Bed, Elephant, and Blackbird Pie. Intimacy appears in Esquire in August. The stories explore new subject matter and approach it in new ways. I feel I'm just beginning to make some discoveries about what I can do with a short story, about what I want to do with my short stories. I'm more or less verging on finding out something, and that's exciting. In May, he and Gallagher attend the 50th anniversary reunion of the Writers' Workshop in Iowa City. He serves as guest editor of Best American Short Stories 1986, contributing an introduction and including stories by Richard Ford, Tess Gallagher, and Tobias Wolff, among others. Together in Carver Country, a profile of Carver and Gallagher in Port Angeles by Tom Jenks, appears in the October issue of Vanity Fair. Random House publishes a second book of his poems, Ultramarine, on November 7. On the same date, he and Gallagher are featured readers at the Modern Poetry Association's annual Poetry Day celebration in Chicago. 1987. The story Menudo appears in the spring issue of Granta, and Errand is published in The New Yorker of June 1. From April through June, Carver and Gallagher visit Paris, Wiesbaden, Zurich, Rome, Milan, London, Dublin, and Belfast. On April 3, American Short Story Masterpieces, an anthology edited by Carver and Jenks, is published by Delacorte Press. In May, Raven Editions publishes Those Days, Early Writings by Raymond Carver. On June 1, In a Marine Light, a selection of poems from Where Water Comes Together with Other Water and Ultramarine, is published in London by Collins Harville. Carver is interviewed by Cassia Boddy for the London Review of Books on June 10. It's a good time in my life right now. I'm writing stories and I'm writing poems. He and Gallagher return to the U.S. and spend the rest of the summer in Port Angeles. Esquire's Guide to the Literary Universe by editor Rust Hills appears in August, and Carver is among those listed at the Red Hot Center. Also in the center are his editors, Gordon Lish, Robert Gottlieb, and Gary Fiskitchen, as well as his literary agent, Amanda Binky Urban of International Creative Management. Of his recovery from alcoholism and second chance at my life again, he tells interviewer Michael Schumacher in late summer, "Every day is a bonus. Every day now is pure cream." 20 years earlier, in his first published interview, he had described himself as a cigarette with a body attached to it. In September, he experiences pulmonary hemorrhages. The diagnosis is cancer. On October 2, at St. Joseph's Hospital in Syracuse, 2/3 of his left lung is removed. On November 11, he is honored at the New York Public Library's annual Literary Lions Gala, where he meets fellow honoree Harold Pinter. Anne Beatty includes Boxes in Best American Short Stories, 1987. 1988. Carver and Gallagher move into a spacious new contemporary home they have purchased east of Port Angeles. Situated on the slopes of the Olympic Mountains, Ridge House is 3 miles inland from Sky House. Carver's study overlooks the woods above Morse Creek, which flows into the strait. He serves as guest judge for the short story annual American Fiction 88. In March, his cancer reappears, this time in his brain. The couple take temporary quarters in Seattle, where he undergoes 7 weeks of radiation therapy at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. Gary Fiskitchen, his editor at Random House, has recently become editorial director of Atlantic Monthly Press. Carter signs a 3-book contract with the firm. The first volume is a collection of stories slated for publication in May. In advance of the book, interviews with Carver appear in major newspapers, including the Boston Globe and the New York Times. "I can't think of anything else I'd rather be called than a writer, unless it's a poet," he tells Publishers Weekly. Short story writer, poet, occasional essayist. In May, he and Gallagher travel to the East Coast, where honors await him. He receives a Creative Arts Award citation for fiction from Brandeis University on May 4. The University of Hartford confers on him the honorary degree of Doctor of Letters at its commencement on Sunday, May 15. That day, his book, Where I'm Calling From, New and Selected Stories, receives front-page coverage in the New York Times Book Review in a highly positive review by novelist Marilyn Robinson. Equally favorable notices appear in the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, Newsweek, and other national publications. He is inducted into the American Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters in New York City on May 18. Despite his illness, he reads from his new collection to a packed house at Endicott Booksellers in Manhattan. He and Gallagher fly back to Seattle, where they both read at the Elliott Bay Book Company on May 24 to an overflowing audience. On June 6, cancer is found in his right lung. Carver and Gallagher are married in the heart of Reno Chapel in Reno, Nevada on June 17. They return to Port Angeles and work on his poetry collection, A New Path to the Waterfall. It is published by Atlantic Monthly Press in 1989 with an introduction by Gallagher. In mid-July, they take a fishing trip to Alaska. On returning to Seattle, he enters Virginia Mason Hospital. He is released to go home with Gallagher to Ridge House. There he dies at 6:20 a.m. on August 2. After a private wake in the home, he is buried in Ocean View Cemetery in Port Angeles on August 4. That same day, a collection of his 7 most recent stories is published in London by Collins Harville under the title Elephant. His valedictory poem, Gravy, appears in The New Yorker on August 20, and his essay, Friendship, is published in the autumn issue of Granta. His last work of fiction, Errand, is selected for inclusion in Best American Short Stories 1988. It also appears in Prize Stories 1988, the O. Henry Awards, where it wins first prize. On September 22, a public memorial service for him is held at St. Peter's Church, on Lexington Avenue in New York City. The black granite monument on Carver's grave above the Strait of Juan de Fuca bears the words poet, short story writer, essayist. Note on the texts. This volume contains 90 short stories by Raymond Carver. These include the complete contents of his books Will You Please Be Quiet, Please? 1976. What We Talk About When We Talk About Love, 1981, and Cathedral, 1983. Also included are the stories in his collections Furious Seasons and Other Stories, 1977, Fires, Essays, Poems, Stories, 1983, and Where I'm Calling From, New and Selected Stories, 1988, that do not appear in his other books. 4 early stories uncollected in his lifetime, and 5 stories discovered after his death in 1988. This volume contains the fragment from the Augustine Notebooks and four of his personal and literary essays. Finally, it publishes for the first time in English, Beginners, the manuscript version of What We Talk About When We Talk About Love. Will You Please Be Quiet, Please? Carver's first collection of short fiction was Will You Please Be Quiet, Please? This book of 22 stories, all of which had previously appeared in periodicals, was published by McGraw-Hill in March 1976. The back flap of the first edition dust jacket states that Will You Please Be Quiet, Please? Is a McGraw-Hill book in association with Gordon Lish. Lish had been Carver's friend since they both worked as textbook editors in California in the late 1960s. Hired as fiction editor of Esquire in 1969, Lish had published Carver's stories Neighbors, What Is It, and Collectors in the magazine between 1971 and 1975. An influential figure in the New York literary scene, who dubbed himself Captain Fiction, Lish was instrumental in convincing McGraw-Hill, a firm specializing in nonfiction, to publish a volume of short stories by a relatively unknown writer who had not established himself with a novel. In November 1974, Carver learned of the publisher's willingness to bring out a collection and signed the contract for Will You Please Be Quiet, Please? In February 1975. During this period, his alcoholism was worsening, leading to extended unemployment and multiple hospitalizations the following year. Deeply grateful to Lish, Carver participated in the book's editing, but for the most part deferred to Lish's judgments about its final form. About the editing necessary in some of the stories, he wrote Lish in a letter of November 11, 1974, "Tell me which ones, and I'll go after it, or them. Tell me which ones, or I will leave it up to you, and you tell me what you think needs done or doing, whatever or both." Lish had edited seven of the stories when Carver submitted them in manuscript to Esquire. He edited the 15 other stories from photocopies of their appearances in print between 1963 and 1973. His alterations included changes of words and phrases, deletions of sentences and paragraphs, and changes of titles. In a letter of September 28, 1975, Carver expressed his thanks for all the blood, sweat, and so on his editor had invested in the book. He also gave his considered approval of the outcome. "I think, all in all, you did a superb job with cutting and fixing on the stories." This volume prints the text of the 1976 McGraw-Hill edition. Following is a list of the first periodical appearances of the 22 stories, nine under alternate titles, in the order of their sequence in the book. Fat, Harper's Bazaar, September 1971. Neighbors, Esquire, June 1971. The Idea, Northwest Review, Fall-Winter, 1971-72. They're Not Your Husband, Chicago Review, Spring 1973. Are You a Doctor? Fiction, 1973. The Father, December, 1968. Nobody Said Anything, as The Summer Steelhead, Seneca Review, May 1973. 60 Acres, Discourse, Winter 1969. What's in Alaska? Iowa Review, Spring 1972. Night School, as Night School, North American Review, Fall 1971. Collectors, Esquire, August 1975. What Do You Do in San Francisco? As Sometimes a Woman Can Just About Ruin a Man, Colorado State Review, Summer 1967. The Student's Wife, Carolina Quarterly, Fall 1964. Put Yourself in My Shoes, Iowa Review, Fall 1972. Jerry and Molly and Sam, as A Dog Story, Perspective, Summer 1972. Why, Honey? As The Man is Dangerous, Sou'wester Literary Quarterly, Winter 1972. The Ducks, as The Night the Mill Boss Died, Carolina Quarterly, Winter 1963. How About This? As Cartwheels, Western Humanities Review, Autumn 1970. Bicycles, Muscles, Cigarettes. As Bicycles, Muscles, Cigarettes. Kansas Quarterly, Winter 1972-73. What is it? Esquire, May 1972, retitled, Are These Actual Miles? In Where I'm Calling From, 1988. Signals, as A Night Out, December 1970. Will you please be quiet, please? December, 1966. The story, Put Yourself in My Shoes, was also separately published by Noel Young's Capra Press in Santa Barbara, California, in 1974, in a trade edition of 500 copies and a limited edition of 75 signed numbered copies. From Furious Seasons and Other Stories. Carver's second collection of short fiction, Furious Seasons and Other Stories, was published by Capra Press in November 1977 in a limited edition of 100 signed numbered copies and a trade edition of 1,200 unsigned copies. The book contained 8 stories in the following sequence: Dummy, Distance, The Lie, So Much Water So Close to Home, The Fling, Pastoral, Mine, Furious Seasons. Revised versions of Dummy, Distance, The Lie, So Much Water So Close to Home, The Fling, and Mine appear in later sections of this volume, and the texts in Furious Seasons are omitted here. The texts of the 2 remaining stories in Furious Seasons are taken from the Capra Press edition. Pastoral was originally published in the winter 1963 issue of Western Humanities Review. In 1982, Carver revised extensively the text of Pastoral as collected in Furious Seasons, changed its title, and published the resulting story as The Cabin in the winter 1983 issue of Indiana Review. That same year, The Cabin was included in his Capra Press collection, Fires. Comparing Pastoral and The Cabin reveals changes in Carver's treatment of a single story over the course of 20 years. For that reason, both Pastoral and The Cabin are included in this volume.